Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Strategic Capital, Champaign, your area IGA food stores, Birch Tree Counseling and Consulting, Champaign, and Swire's Land and Management Company, Danville. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
It's 2:40. In sports, Southern Illinois is second in the preseason Missouri Valley Football Conference preseason rankings behind Northern Iowa. The two teams shared the conference title last season. Illinois State is projected to finish eighth in the conference. St. Louis Cardinals right-hander Kyle Loesch looks to repeat his early season performance against Houston tonight as he takes the mound against the Astros. Loesch tossed a three-hitter for his seventh career complete game in a 3-0 victory in April. Two winning streaks are on the line tonight as the Chicago Cubs open a 3-game series with the Philadelphia Phillies. The Cubs have won 4 straight, while the Phillies have won 8 in a row. 9-game winner Ted Lilly is scheduled to take the mound for the Cubs after left knee inflammation pushed back his scheduled start for 2 days. The Chicago White Sox find themselves just 1.5 games out of the American League Central lead heading into tonight's series opener with the Tampa Bay Rays. Tampa also has been surging, winning 14 of its last 20 games to move within 4.5 games of the top of the AL East. Shaquille O'Neal would deluge Michael Phelps in a cannonball competition. What about a race across the pool? Well, the NBA superstar will star in Shaq Versus, a TV series where the All-Star Center will challenge top athletes in their respective sports. During one episode, which debuts on August 8th on ABC, Shaq will swim against Olympic superstar Michael Phelps. That's a look at sports. It's 2:43. Big dairy farms produce more than just milk. They also generate manure, lots and lots of it. And that can be a problem for farmers and the environment. Todd Melby reports on a technology that reduces manure and generates electricity.
I'm on a dairy farm with John Vries and his daughter Brittany. Oh, and some cows, too. Vries is a frugal man. A couple of winters ago, he had a contest with his son to see who could use the least electricity. Vries was willing to go to extreme measures. His daughter Brittany tells the story this way.
But he'd shut his fridge off and in the wintertime just use the outdoors for his fridge. So he was definitely trying to keep the kilowatts down.
And so what did he do? He just kept his milk in the porch and kept his frozen stuff outside?
Yep.
Today, Vries isn't just trying to save energy. He's trying to create it. From cow dung. He's got 1,600 head of cattle at his place here in western Wisconsin. Those cows produce milk that gets made into cheese, but they also produce about 50,000 gallons of manure every day. Farmers are required to store that manure in a big pool-like structure called a lagoon. John Vries covers his up with a giant tarp.
It would blow up from the biogas. It looked like a great big balloon or like the Metrodome for folks in the cities. And it's from the natural decomposition of the manure, and it creates biogas. And we would have to take that gas from out from underneath the cover and flare it off, which got us to thinking about, well, there's got to be a better way to use that energy than just to flare it off.
So Vries bought a $1 million machine called a digester. And he had help from the federal government. They paid for a quarter of it. The government is interested in these things because they can turn manure into energy. And it turns out the reason it's called a digester is a farm thing.
But a cow has 4 stomachs. Well, we call the digester really the 5th stomach because all the stuff that comes out of the back end of the cow, we then put in that digester.
So this 5th stomach produces energy. However, it's not ready to use energy. To sell it as natural gas, it has to be about 95% methane. The gas from the digester is only about 60% methane. Another option is to convert it to electricity. But in the U.S., electricity is cheap.
And you're tried to sell it to the electric company, but they didn't want it?
Yeah, they're not offering us enough money, so.
After all this investment by Vries and the federal government, Some of the gas he collects is just being burned off into the air, but maybe not for long. Vries wants to build a greenhouse right on his Wisconsin farm so he can grow vegetables and herbs in the winter. He says he'll power it with energy from the digester.
So instead of your produce coming from 2,000 miles away in the Central Valley of California, wouldn't it be neat if it came from 45 miles away?
Vries is planning to use the water from the cow manure for his vegetables and herbs in his greenhouse. And he's got a machine similar to ones used at wastewater treatment plants to clean the manure water. But even with the digester, there's still leftover manure that he has to deal with. But Vries says the digester makes it more manageable. Some of the dry manure is blown into a pile where it's gathered up and used as bedding for the cows. In the summer, it's also used for another purpose.
I mean, it's just a clean version of manure. I mean, it stinks a little bit, but most of the stink's been taken out of it. And we mix this with potting soil, and it works great for the plants.
That manure potting soil mix is sold to gardeners in the city. It's another way for Vries to be frugal and environmental at the same time. For the Environment Report, I'm Todd Milby.
Support for the Environment Report comes from the Park Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation. You can find more information and share your thoughts at environmentreport.org.
Next time on PRI's The World, 4 years of dry weather has lowered reservoirs and aquifers across the Middle East. The problem could be permanent. Demand for water is going up, just as supplies dry up. Israelis and Palestinians are at odds over who gets to use shrinking supplies of water. That story in the day's news, coming up today on The World at 3 o'clock here on AM 580, FM 90.9 HD2, and online at will.illinois.edu. This Wednesday, WILL-TV and many other public television stations will broadcast an episode of Time Team America. The show will feature a little-known part of American history in Pike County, Illinois. Jim Lenz visited the video crew last summer on location near the Pike County town of Barry.
Let us break bread together on our knees.
Drive along a stretch of highway near Barry, Illinois, in Pike County, and you'll see farmland. Some highway signs commemorating Free Frank McWhorter may give you pause to wonder who he was. Once the vision of a slave brought a bustling town to life on the prairie, the first town in the U.S. founded and laid out by an African-American. Free Frank's story still has some gaps. The last several summers have seen archaeological work at the site of the former New Philadelphia. Next Wednesday evening, an episode of Time Team America will take us to the dig. Graham Dixon created the original version of Time Team in the U.K. He says the team's goal was clear, but the target would not be easy to find.
We've been asked here to bring in our team of archaeologists and some extra resources to look at an area on this site to help the research that's going on here. So we've been looking at a couple of units within the town plan to see if we can find evidence of the schoolhouse, which was built in the kind of 1850s, I think. And that's quite a hard target because you're talking about a wooden building, maybe on a couple of stones, you know, and a lot of the wood perishes, so you're left with a few stones and the kind of very faint imprint. But what we're hoping is that we'd find some artifacts from the school that would help us tell the story of the people that are living here back then.
Eric Dietz is the team's archaeologist. He says finding the school would not be easy, but it tells us a lot about the town and Free Frank.
Well, the physical side of the schoolhouse, we don't really know. There is a document, I believe, from 1858 that said that a couple of deed transferences that said that they had left this corner of this lot aside for the construction of a schoolhouse. Again, those are always in the future tense. So there's some speculation as to whether it ever got built on this lot. And that's one of the things we were trying to answer. Was the building ever built on this lot? The other thing that's interesting about this school is that in the normal situation in Illinois, you would have a very prescribed sort of placement and standard building, and sort of the schoolhouses were all very regular, but this was a schoolhouse that was established for the African-American children who at that time were being excluded from the regular educational process by the different black laws in Illinois at the time. So the folks, Free Frank and others in the town of New Philadelphia, had pushed to get a school for the African-American children within the town.
Dietz says the school building was most likely only 20 feet by 30 feet and was built on piers, so the team probably won't find a foundation to show them where the school sat. Those possibilities forced Colin Campbell to go back to the drawing board. Campbell is the team's two-dimensional artist.
Well, for one interesting thing in terms of the archaeology was I was first drawing the school sitting on the ground, you know, with a solid footprint because I just assumed to be a regular building. But talking to Anna, one of the main archaeologists for New Philadelphia, she was describing it as it's possible that it would be up on piers and sort of blocks at the corners of the building, and that would change the archaeological footprint. So when you're looking for evidence of the building, it changes based upon if it was sitting on the ground or if it was on these piers. Now, that's an archaeological misconception, but there could be any number of, you know, social or cultural misconceptions talking about an African-American frontier home or an integrated town in North America at this time, too.
Campbell takes the ideas of the archaeologist and turns them into graphic images. You will see some of his work on the show Wednesday evening. Archaeologist Dietz says the very existence of the school gives us a glimpse into Free Frank's thoughts.
The state regulation that says that the schools have to be segregated. What we have in the situation here, to my understanding, is it's Frank McWhorter and his sons, as they did in a lot of different issues, have tried to get an end around the racial laws in Illinois at the time to create a school. So basically they were fighting against that the law of segregation. What we don't know is whether the white children would have gone to this school, if it would have been a completely segregated school, because later, by 1900, I believe, the school that was down the road was for both white and African-American students as well. So I think what you have, rather than sort of playing into the segregated idea of education at the time, I think they were trying to get around that. I think they were trying to subvert the idea that you need to have segregated education, and they were trying to establish a school where the African-American children could go and participate.
Free Frank himself was illiterate, so we have no journals recording his thoughts. He certainly wanted an education for the African-American children in his town. The episode of Time Team America will air Wednesday night on many PBS stations.
That was Jim Lenz of public radio station WQUB in Quincy, Illinois. Time Team America airs Wednesday night at 7 on WILL-TV. It's 2:53. One person's affront is another's joyful activity. Commentator Amy Gaida found out as much when she took a virtual trip to the Oregon Country Fair, County Fair. Here's this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News.
Every year, my sisters-in-law attend a public spectacle known as the Oregon Country Fair near Eugene, Oregon. I share in the experience through photographs. Don't mistake it for the type of fair that features best beans or tastiest torts. Celebrate with us in mid-July, the website welcomes, and delight in our world-class entertainment, handmade crafts, delectable foods, educational displays, and magical surprises at every turn of the path. Those magical surprises at the path's every turn would include nudity or near nudity. Perhaps your meandering will lead to a woman wearing only a loincloth and maybe some sort of pasties, or a man wearing only a thong. Maybe a cellist will appear, apparently wearing only his cello, or a man who has twisted and then placed strategically a flimsy plastic grocery store bag. The fair promises that you can people watch like you've never people watched before. And I can tell you from my web-based viewing experience that that is absolutely true. Perhaps your Midwestern sensibilities lead you to ask the same scholarly question I did: how the heck can they do that sort of thing in public? The answer is that Oregon state law, at least the public indecency statute, is very specific. Public indecency in the Oregon Code has a very narrow definition, one not appropriately described here other than to say a certain state of mind is relevant to conviction. There's that, and the fact that the Oregon Country Fair is on hundreds of acres of land where the reach of the law is thwarted both by distance and by happily accepting attendees. There aren't any cases in Oregon regarding public nudity precisely on point, but let's try two you-make-the-call questions. What would you do with a woman who insisted on swimming nude in a public canal because, she argued, her choice of garb and location wasn't anyone else's business? How about a woman who rode her bike in the nude in all kinds of weather to help educate those opposed to public nudity? If you answered that you'd set the women free instead of committing them for mental health treatment, you'd be right in line with what the Oregon courts did. This is not to say, of course, that all nudity is welcome or that certain municipalities don't have stricter rules. Don't call me from the jailhouse in Portland, for example, where the law isn't as generous. Besides, even seemingly approving Oregon judges acknowledge that what isn't public indecency could well be disorderly conduct or even public nuisance. Just ask the couple who bought lovely Oregon beachfront land, only to be repeatedly accosted by hundreds of sunbathing neighbors wearing absolutely nothing. The couple successfully sued the state for refusing to stop the encroaching visuals. So let's travel back to the Oregon Country Fair via its website. The Oregon Country Fair creates events and experiences, promoters promise, that nourish the spirit, explore living artfully and authentically on Earth, and transform culture in magical, joyous, and healthy ways. I think we can all agree that, yes, culture is being transformed. But from a vantage point several states away, it's not clear that that plastic grocery store bag is anywhere near magical or joyous. I'm Amy Guida.
Amy Guida is an assistant professor of journalism and law at the University of Illinois.
Earth and Sky.
40 years ago, on July 20th, 1969, NASA astronauts Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin took the first ever human steps on the moon. Earth Sky asked astronaut Buzz Aldrin what he remembers most about it.
Well, the entire experience was the culmination of just a very fortunate set of circumstances that opened up for us. 30 people were destined to be among those selected to maybe make the first landing on the moon.
Today, Aldrin urges the U.S. to help other nations like China, India, South Korea, and Brazil to reach the moon, and for the U.S. to send its astronauts to Mars.
What we challenged ourselves to do in a confrontational situation of the 60s and 70s in expanding the horizons of human exploration, we can challenge ourselves to do during this period of brief recession, discouragement as a nation and as a world. We can challenge ourselves to do great things again by joining forces cooperatively with patience and perseverance.
Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
WILO programs are made possible in part by Bevere Cafe 2, offering gourmet sandwiches, salads, and specialty coffees with seating inside or outside in the lower courtyard of the Institute for Genomic Biology next to Morrow Plotz on the U of I campus.
How is the recession affecting your